cares for his little person. Why, good heavens, one who feels his heart inflamed by this heavenly fire seeks to pour it forth and to display his inner self. He would be eager to show his heart upon his face. He will never think of any other cosmetics. I remembered the compendium of his morality, which Madame d'Epinay had told me of, and which she had adopted. This consisted of one single article, namely, that the sole duty of man is to follow in everything the inclinations of his heart. This code of morality, when I heard of it, afforded me terrible material for thought, although at that time I only looked upon it as a witticism. But I soon saw that this principle was really his rule of conduct, and in the sequel I had only too convincing proof of it, at my own expense. It is the inner doctrine of which Diderot has so often spoken to me, but of which he has never given me any explanation. I remembered the frequent warnings that I had received several years before that the man was false, that he was only playing at sentiment, and that above all he had no affection for me. I recollect several little incidents which Monsieur de Franqueuil and Madame de Chenonceau had related to me on that point. Neither of them had any esteem for him, and both ought to have known him well, since Madame de Chenonceau was the daughter of Madame de Rochechouart, the intimate friend of the late Comte de Frise, and Monsieur de Franqueuil, who was at that time very intimate with the Vicomte de Polignac, had lived much in the Palais Royal just at the time when Grimm began to secure a footing there. All Paris heard of his despair after the death of the Comte de Frise. It was a question of keeping up the reputation which he had gained after the cruel treatment he had experienced from Mademoiselle Fell, the humbug of which I should have seen through better than anyone else, if I had not been so blind. He had to be dragged to the Hotel Castries, where, abandoning himself to the most deadly affliction, he played his part worthily. Every morning he went into the garden to weep at his ease, holding before his eyes his handkerchief drenched with tears, as long as he was in sight of the hotel. But as soon as he turned round into a certain narrow street, persons of whom he had no suspicion saw him immediately put his handkerchief in his pocket and pull out a book. He was seen to do this more than once, and the fact soon became public property in Paris, and was almost as soon forgotten. I had forgotten it myself. A fact which concerned myself reminded me of it. I was in bed, at death's door, in the Rue de Grenelle. He was in the country. One morning he came to see me, quite out of breath, and declared that he'd only just arrived. A minute afterwards I learned that he'd arrived the day before, and that he'd been seen in the theatre the same day. A thousand little incidents of this kind came back to me, but something which I was surprised that I had not observed sooner struck me most of all. I had introduced Grimm to all my friends without exception. They had all become his. I was so inseparable from him that I should hardly have cared to continue visiting at a house to which he had not the entry. Only Madame de Crequy refused to admit him, and from that time I also almost entirely discontinued my visits to her. Grimm, on his part, made other friends, both on his own initiative and also through the Comte de Frise. Of all those friends, not a single one ever became mine. He never said a word to me to induce me at least to make their acquaintance. And of all those whom I sometimes met at his rooms, not one ever showed me the least goodwill, not even the Comte de Frise, with whom he lived, and with whom it would consequently have been very pleasant to me to form a connection. Nor the Comte de Schomberg, his relation, with whom Grimm was even more intimate. More than this, my own friends, whom I made his own, and who had all been devotedly attached to me before they made his acquaintance, showed a sensible alteration in their feelings and behaviour towards me after they had made it. He never introduced one of his friends to me. I introduced him to all mine, and he ended by depriving me of them all. If such are the results of friendship, what will be the results of hatred? Diderot himself at the outset warned me several times that Grimm, upon whom I bestowed such confidence, was not my friend. Subsequently he altered his tone when he himself had ceased to be a friend. The manner in which I had disposed of my children had required no one's assistance. However, I informed my friends of it, simply for the sake of informing them, in order not to appear better in their eyes than I really was. These friends were three in number, Diderot, Grimm, and Madame d'Épinay. Duclos, who was the most worthy of my confidence, was the only one whom I did not inform. However, he knew it. From whom, I do not know. It is hardly probable that Madame d'Épinay was guilty of this breach of confidence, for she well knew that, by imitating it, if I had been capable of doing so, I could have cruelly avenged myself. There remain Grimm and Diderot, at that time so closely united in many things, especially against myself, that it is more than probable that they were both guilty. I would wager that Duclos, to whom I did not reveal my secret, and who was consequently in no way bound to silence, was the only one who faithfully kept it. Grimm and Diderot, in their scheme of getting the women folk away from me, had done their utmost to induce him to enter into their plans, but he always scornfully refused. It was not until later that I learned from him all that had taken place between them in the matter. But I learned enough at the time from Thérèse to see that in the whole affair there was some secret design, and that they were anxious to dispose of me, if not against my will, at least without my knowledge. Or that they certainly wished to make use of these two persons as their tools in some secret design. In all this there was certainly something very dishonourable. The opposition of Duclos proves it beyond contradiction. Let him who pleases believe that it was friendship. This pretended friendship was as disastrous to me at home as outside. The long and frequent conversations with Madame Levasseur, for several years past, had perceptibly altered her feelings towards me, and this alteration was most certainly not favourable to me. What, then, was the subject of discussion during these singular tête-à-têtes? Why this deep mystery? Was the conversation of this old woman sufficiently agreeable for it to be considered such a piece of good fortune, or sufficiently important to make such a mystery about it? During the 3 or 4 years that these conferences lasted, they had appeared to me ridiculous, but when I reconsidered them, I began to wonder at them. This feeling of wonder would have ended in uneasiness if I had known at the time what this woman was plotting against me. In spite of Grimm's pretended zeal for me, of which he boasted so loudly outside, and which was difficult to reconcile with the tone which he assumed towards me in my presence, I gained nothing by it from any point of view, and the pity which he pretended to feel for me served less to benefit than to humiliate me. He even, as far as lay his power, deprived me of the benefits of the profession which I had chosen for myself by depreciating my abilities as a copyist. I admit that in that he spoke the truth, but it was not his place to do so. He clearly showed that he did not intend it as a joke, by employing another copyist himself, and taking away from me all the customers he could. One would have said that his object was to make me dependent upon him and his interest for my subsistence, and to exhaust my resources until I should be reduced to such a condition. All things being taken into consideration, my reason at last imposed silence upon my former prejudice in his favour, which still made itself heard. I came to the conclusion that his character was, at least, very suspicious, and as for his friendship, I decided that it was false. Accordingly, having made up my mind not to see him again, I informed Madame d'Épinay of my determination, which I justified by several unanswerable reasons, which I have now forgotten. She strongly opposed this determination, without exactly knowing what reply to make to the reasons which had decided me. She had not yet come to an understanding with him. But on the following day, instead of entering into a verbal explanation with me, she sent me a very cleverly worded letter, which they had drawn up together, in which, without entering into details, she excused him on the ground of his reserved disposition, and imputing it as a crime to me that I had suspected him of treachery towards his friend, exhorted me to become reconciled to him. This letter shook my determination in a conversation which subsequently took place between us, when I found her better prepared than she had been the first time. I allowed myself to be completely vanquished. I persuaded myself that I might have judged wrongly, and that in this case I had really committed a grave wrong towards a friend, which it was my duty to repair. In short, as I had several times already done in the case of Diderot and the Baron d'Holbach, partly of my own accord and partly through weakness, I made all those advances which I had a right to demand. I went to see Grimm like a second Georges Dandin. This was a character in Molière's comedy of the same name, also called Le Mari Confondu. Georges Dandin is a peasant who marries a woman of distinguished family. To apologize for offences of which he had been guilty against myself, always under the mistaken conviction which all my life long has caused me to abase myself before my pretended friends, that there is no hatred so strong that it cannot be disarmed by gentleness and good behaviour. Whereas, on the contrary, the hatred of the wicked is only strengthened by the impossibility of finding anything to justify it, and the consciousness of their own injustice is only an additional grievance against him who is the victim of it. Without going further than my own history, I have a strong proof of this axiom in the conduct of Grimm and Tronchin, who became my two most implacable enemies, of their own inclination, for their own pleasure, out of sheer caprice, without being able to quote a single instance of any kind in which I had done either of them wrong. It was not until later that I nicknamed the latter jongleur, juggler, long after his declaration of hostility and the cruel persecution which he stirred up against me at Geneva and elsewhere. I even soon suppressed the name when I saw that I was entirely his victim. I consider mean and paltry vengeance unworthy of my heart, and hatred never sets foot in it. And whose rage increases daily like that of the tiger from the ease with which they are able to glut it. I expected that Grimm, confused by my condescension and advances, would receive me with open arms and the tenderest affection. As a fact, he received me like a Roman emperor, with an unparalleled haughtiness. I was utterly unprepared for this reception, embarrassed at having to play a part so ill-suited to me. In a few words, I timidly explained the object of my visit. Before taking me back into favour, he delivered, with great dignity, a long harangue which he had prepared, containing a list of his numerous and rare virtues, especially in matters of friendship. He dwelt for some time upon a circumstance, which at first struck me considerably, that he always kept the same friends. While he was speaking, I said to myself that it would be cruel on my part to make myself the only exception to this rule. He returned to this so frequently and with such affectation that he at last made me think that, if in this he only listened to the feelings of his heart, he would show himself less struck by this sentiment which he so freely expressed, and that he was making use of it as a trick which might serve his purpose of self-advancement. Hitherto I had been in the same case. I had always kept all my friends. Since my earliest childhood I had not lost a single one, except by death. And yet I had never made it a subject of reflection. It was not a principle which I had laid down for myself. Since we both had this advantage in common, what right had he to boast of it as peculiar to himself, unless he already designed to deprive me of it? He devoted himself to the task of humiliating me by proving that our mutual friends preferred him to me. I was as well aware as he was of this preference. The question was how he had obtained it. By superior merits or address? By exalting himself? Or by endeavouring to humiliate me? At last, when he'd put between us to his heart's content all the distance which could attach value to the favour which he intended to grant me, he bestowed upon me the kiss of peace, in a slight embrace, which resembled the accolade which the king bestows upon newly created knights. I fell from the clouds. I was amazed. I did not know what to say. I could not utter a single word. The whole scene had the appearance of a reprimand given by a master to a pupil when he lets him off a flogging. I never think of it without feeling how deceptive are judgments founded upon appearances, to which the vulgar attach such weight, and how frequently audacity and pride are on the side of the guilty, shame and embarrassment on the side of the innocent. We were reconciled. This was at least a relief to my heart, which is always mortally distressed by a quarrel. It may be imagined that such a reconciliation produced no alteration in his manners. It simply deprived me of the right of complaining of them. Accordingly, I resolved to endure everything and to say nothing. So many annoyances, one after another, threw me into a state of depression, which scarcely left me strength to regain command of myself. Without any reply from Saint Lambert, neglected by Madame Dudetot, no longer venturing to open my heart to anyone, I began to fear that, in making friendship the idol of my heart, I had wasted my life in sacrificing to chimeras. In proof of this, out of all my friendships, there only remained two men who had retained my full esteem, and whom my heart could trust. Duclos, whom I'd lost sight of since my retirement to the Hermitage, and Saint Lambert. I believed that I could only repair my injustice towards the latter by opening my heart to him unreservedly, and I resolved to make a full and complete confession to him, in everything which did not compromise his mistress. I have no doubt that this resolution was another snare set by my passion, in order to keep me closer to it. But it is certain that I should have thrown myself unreservedly into her lover's arms, that I should have submitted myself completely to his guidance, and that I should have pushed my frankness as far as it could go. I was ready to write a second letter to him, to which I felt sure that he would reply, when I learned the melancholy reason of his silence in regard to the first. He had been unable to endure the fatigues of the campaign to the end. Madame d'Épinay informed me that he had just had a stroke of paralysis, and Madame Dudetot, whose affliction at last made her ill herself, and who was not in a fit state to write to me immediately, sent me word 2 or 3 days later from Paris, where she was at that time, that he intended to be removed to Aix-la-Chapelle to take the baths. I do not say that this melancholy news afflicted me as much as her, but I doubt whether the sorrow which it caused me was less painful than her grief and tears. Sorrow at knowing him to be in such a condition, aggravated by the apprehension that uneasiness might have contributed to it, touched me more than all that hitherto happened to me, and I felt, to my cruel sorrow, that I could not find in my own self-esteem the strength which I needed in order to support such grief. Happily, this generous friend did not long leave me in such a state of depression. In spite of his illness, he did not forget me, and I soon learned from himself that I had ill-judged his feelings and condition. But it is time to proceed to the great and sudden change in my destiny, the catastrophe which has divided my life into two parts, so different from each other, and which, from a very trifling cause, has drawn such terrible effects. One day, when I least expected it, Madame d'Épinay sent for me. When I entered the room, I observed, in her eyes and manner, an appearance of embarrassment, which was the more striking to me, as it was unusual, since no one in the world knew better than she how to control her features and movements. "My friend," said she, "I am leaving for Geneva. My chest is in a bad state. My health is breaking up so rapidly that I must go and consult Tronchin, even if I have to neglect everything else." This resolution, so abruptly taken at the commencement of bad weather, astonished me the more, as, when I left her 36 hours before, not a word had been said about it. I asked her whom she intended to take with her. She told me that she meant to take her son and Monsieur de Linon, and then added, in an indifferent tone, "And won't you come too, my dear bear?" As I did not believe that she spoke seriously, since she knew that, in the time of year upon which we were just entering, I was hardly in a fit state to leave my room, I spoke jestingly of the advantage of one sick person being accompanied by another. She herself did not seem to have meant the proposition seriously, and nothing more was said about it. During the rest of my visit we spoke of nothing but the preparations for her journey, into which she threw herself with great energy, as she had made up her mind to start in a fortnight. I did not need much penetration to understand that there was some secret reason for this journey which was concealed from me. The secret, which was a secret to me alone in the house, was discovered the very next day by Thérèse, to whom Tessier, the maître d'hôtel, who had heard it from the lady's maid, revealed it. Although I am under no obligation to Madame Épinay to keep the secret, since I did not learn it from her, it is too closely connected with those which she did confide to me, for me to be able to make any distinction. On this point, therefore, I will say nothing, but these same secrets which never have been, and never will be revealed by me, either by word of mouth or the pen, have become known to too many for it to be possible that they can have remained unknown to any of Madame d'Épinay's associates. When I was informed of the true motive of this journey, I should have recognized the secret instigation of the hand of an enemy in the attempt to make me the chaperon of Madame d'Épinay. But as she had not pressed me at all to accompany her, I persisted in regarding the attempt as not seriously intended. And I merely laughed at the fine figure that I should have cut, if I had been foolish enough to undertake the charge. Besides, she gained considerably by my refusal, for she succeeded in persuading her husband himself to accompany her. A few days afterwards I received the following letter from Diderot. This letter, merely folded in two, so that anyone could easily read its contents, was addressed to me, care of Madame d'Épinay, and entrusted to Monsieur de Linon, the tutor of the son and the confidant of the mother. Letter from Diderot, Packet A, number 52. I am born to love you and to cause you annoyance. I hear that Madame d'Épinay is going to Geneva, and I do not hear it said that you accompany her. My friend, if you are satisfied with Madame d'Épinay, you must go with her. If you are dissatisfied, you must go all the more readily. Are you overburdened with the weight of the obligations under which she has laid you? Here is an opportunity of partly discharging them and of lightening your burden. Will you find another opportunity in your life of showing your gratitude to her? She is going into a country where she will be as if she had fallen from the clouds. She is ill. She will need amusement and distraction. Winter, too. Consider, my friend, the objection on the score of your health may be far stronger than I think it is, but are you worse today than you were a month ago, and than you will be at the beginning of spring? Will you make the journey 3 months hence more comfortably than now? For myself, I declare to you that if I could not endure the carriage, I would take a stick and follow her. Then, are you not afraid that your behaviour may be misinterpreted? You will be suspected either of ingratitude or of some other secret motive. I am well aware that, whatever you do, you will always have the testimony of your conscience on your side. But is this testimony sufficient by itself? And is it allowed to neglect, up to a certain point, that of other men? Besides, my friend, I write this letter in order to discharge an obligation to you as well as to myself. If it displeases you, throw it in the fire and think no more of it than if it had never been written. I salute, love, and embrace you. I trembled with rage and felt so utterly astounded while reading this letter that I could scarcely finish it. But this did not prevent me from observing how cleverly Diderot affected a gentler, more flattering, and more polite tone than in any of his other letters, in which he had most addressed me as my dear, without condescending to call me friend. I easily perceived the indirect means by which this letter had reached me. The address, style, and the way in which it arrived betrayed the roundabout manner of proceeding clumsily enough, for we usually corresponded through the post or the Montmorency messenger, and this was the first and only time that he made use of the present method of communication. When my first transports of indignation permitted me to write, I hastily threw off the following reply, which I immediately took from the Hermitage, where I was at the time, to La Chevrette, to show it to Madame d'Épinay, to whom in my blind passion I intended to read it, as well as Diderot's letter. My dear friend, you cannot know either the extent of my obligations to Madame d'Épinay, or how far they are binding, or whether she has really need of me on her journey, or wishes me to accompany her, or whether it is possible for me to do so, or the reasons I may have for refusing. I do not object to discuss all these points with you, But in the meantime, you must admit that to dictate to me so positively what I ought to do, without being in a position to judge, is, my dear philosopher, to talk nonsense. The worst thing about it is that I see that the opinion is not your own, not to mention that I am little disposed to allow myself to be led by a third or fourth party under your name. I find in these indirect acts a certain amount of underhandedness, which ill suits your frankness, which, for both our sakes, you will do well to avoid for the future. You express yourself afraid that my conduct may be misinterpreted, but I defy a heart like yours to venture to think ill of mine. Others would perhaps speak better of me, if I were more like them. Heaven preserve me from gaining their approval. Let the wicked spy upon me and interpret my conduct as they please. Rousseau is not a man to fear them, or Diderot a man to listen to them. You wish me to throw your letter in the fire, if it displeases me, and to think no more about it. Do you think that what comes from you can be so easily forgotten? My dear friend, you hold my tears, in the pain which you cause me, as cheap as my life and health, in the care which you exhort me to take. If you could correct yourself of this, your friendship would be so much sweeter to me, and I should be so much the less to be pitied. On entering Madame d'Épinay's room, I found Grimm with her, which delighted me. I read to them, in a loud and clear voice, my two letters, with an intrepidity of which I should not have believed myself capable, and when I had finished, I added a few remarks which did not belie it. I saw that this unexpected audacity on the part of a man usually so timid astonished and astounded them both. They did not answer a word. Above all, I saw that arrogant man cast down his eyes, not venturing to meet the angry flashes from my own. But at the same instant, in the bottom of his heart, he was vowing my destruction, and I am positive that they agreed upon it before they parted. It was about this time that I at last received, through Madame Dudetot, Saint-Lambert's letter, packet A, number 57, dated from Wolfenbüttel, a few days after his accident, written in answer to mine, which had been greatly delayed on the road. This reply afforded me some consolation, which I greatly needed at that moment, in the proofs of esteem and friendship of which it was full, and which gave me the courage and strength to deserve them. From that moment I did my duty, but it is certain that if Saint-Lambert had shown himself less sensible, less generous, less a man of honour, I should have been lost beyond recall. The weather became bad, and people were beginning to leave the country. Madame Dudetot informed me of the day on which she intended to come and say good-bye to our valley, and made an appointment to meet me at Aubon. It so happened that it was the day on which Madame d'Épinay was leaving La Chevrette for Paris, in order to make her final preparations for her journey. Fortunately, she set out in the morning, and I still had time, after leaving her, to go and dine with her sister-in-law. I had Saint-Lambert's letter in my pocket, and read it several times as I walked along. It acted as a shield against my weakness. I made and kept the resolution to see in Madame Dudetot nothing but my friend and my friend's mistress, and I spent 4 or 5 hours in her company, tête-à-tête, in a delightful calm, infinitely preferable, even in the matter of enjoyment, to the attacks of burning fever which I had hitherto felt in her presence. As she knew only too well that my heart was unchanged, she was grateful for the efforts I had made to control myself. It increased her esteem for me, and I had the pleasure of seeing that her friendship for me was not extinguished. She informed me of the speedy return of Saint-Lambert, who, although he had almost recovered from his attack, was no longer in a condition to endure the fatigues of war, and was leaving the service in order to live quietly with her. We formed the charming plan of an intimate companionship between us three, and we had reason to hope that the execution of this plan would be lasting in its results. Seeing that all the feelings which can unite upright and feeling hearts were the foundation of it, and we combined, in our three selves, sufficient talents and knowledge to render any foreign elements unnecessary. Alas, while abandoning myself to the prospect of so charming a life, I little thought of that which awaited me. We afterwards spoke of my relations with Madame d'Épinay. I showed her Diderot's letter, together with my answer. I told her all the circumstances connected with it, and informed her of my resolution to leave the Hermitage. She vigorously opposed it, and with arguments which were all powerful with my heart. She declared that she would have much liked me to go with her to Geneva, as she foresaw that she would inevitably be compromised by my refusal. Indeed, Diderot's letter seemed to announce it beforehand. However, as she knew my reasons as well as myself, she did not insist upon this point. But she begged me at any price to avoid scandal, and to palliate my refusal by reasons sufficiently plausible to remove the unjust suspicion that she had anything to do with it. I told her that it was no easy task that she was imposing upon me, but that, being resolved to atone for my offences, even at the cost of my reputation, I desired to give the preference to hers, as far as honour would allow me to go. It will soon be seen whether I knew how to keep my promise. I can swear that, far from my unfortunate passion having lost any of its force, I never loved my Sophie so fondly, so tenderly, as on that day. But Saint Lambert's letter, my sense of duty, and horror of treachery, made such an impression upon me that, during the whole of the interview, my senses left me completely at peace in her company, and I was not even tempted to kiss her hand. At parting, she kissed me before her servants. This kiss, so different from those which I had sometimes stolen from her beneath the trees, was a guarantee to me that I had regained command over myself. I am nearly certain that, if my heart had had time to strengthen itself without interruption, 3 months would have been more than enough to cure me completely. Here end my personal relations with Madame d'Oudetot, relations of which every man has been able to judge by appearances according to the nature of his own heart, but in which the passion with which this amiable woman inspired me, the liveliest passion that a man has perhaps ever felt, will always be honoured in heaven's sight and our own by the rare and painful sacrifices which we both made to duty, honour, love, and friendship. We had too high an opinion of each other to be able to degrade ourselves easily. We must have been utterly unworthy of esteem to make up our minds to lose a mutual regard of such great value. And the energy of our feelings, which might have made us guilty, was the very thing which prevented us from becoming so. Thus, after a long friendship for the one of these two women, and a deep affection for the other, I took farewell of both on the same day. Of one, never to see her again in my life, of the other, only to see her twice more, upon occasions of which I shall afterwards speak. After their departure, I found myself greatly embarrassed how to fulfil so many urgent and contradictory obligations, the result of my follies. If I had been in my natural position, after the proposal of the journey to Geneva had been made, and I had declined it, I need only have remained quiet, and there would have been nothing more to be said. But I had foolishly made of it a matter which could not remain where it was, and I could only avoid further explanation by leaving the Hermitage, which I had just promised Madame d'Oudetot not to do, at least for the present. Besides, she had asked me to make my excuses for my refusal to my so-called friends, to prevent it being laid to her charge. And yet, I could not declare the real reason without insulting Madame d'Épinay, to whom I certainly owed some gratitude, after all she had done for me. After carefully considering everything, I found myself confronted by the cruel but unavoidable alternatives of showing disrespect to Madame d'Épinay, Madame d'Oudetot, or myself. I chose the last. I chose it boldly, unreservedly, without shuffling, and with a generosity which surely deserved to expiate the offences which had reduced me to such an extremity. This sacrifice, which my enemies perhaps expected, and by which they have known how to profit, has caused the ruin of my reputation, and, thanks to their efforts, has robbed me of the esteem of the public. but it has restored to me my own, and has consoled me in my misfortunes. This is not the last time, as will be seen, that I have made similar sacrifices, nor the last time that they have been taken advantage of to overwhelm me. Grimm was the only one who appeared to have taken no part in this affair, and it was to him that I resolved to address myself. I wrote a long letter to him, in which I exposed the absurdity of wishing me to look upon it as my duty to take the journey to Geneva, the uselessness of it, even the embarrassment I should have been to Madame d'Épinay, and the inconveniences which would have resulted to myself. In this letter, I could not resist the temptation of letting him see that I was well informed, and that it seemed to me singular that anyone should expect me to undertake the journey, while he himself was considered exempt, and his name was not even mentioned. This letter, in which, owing to its being impossible for me to state my reasons outright, I was often obliged to wander from the point, might have presented the appearance of guilt to the general public. But it was a model of prudence and discretion for those who, like Grimm, were well acquainted with the facts, which I did not mention in it, and which fully justified my conduct. I did not even shrink from exciting a further prejudice against myself by foisting Diderot's advice upon my other friends, in order to hint that Madame Dudateau had thought the same, as in fact was the case, and by avoiding to mention that, in consequence of my arguments, she had changed her opinion. There was no better way of clearing her from the suspicion of connivance on her part than by seeming to be dissatisfied with her conduct in this respect. This letter concluded with an exhibition of confidence by which any other man would have been touched. While I exhorted Grimm to consider my reasons well, and afterwards to inform me of his opinion, I gave him to understand that his advice, whatever it might be, would be followed. Such was really my intention, even if he had declared himself in favour of my going. As Monsieur d'Épinay had undertaken to be his wife's escort on the journey, my company would have assumed quite a different aspect. Whereas, at first, it was I who was asked to undertake this duty, and there was no question of Monsieur d'Épinay until I had refused. Grimm did not reply for some time. His answer was curious. I will here give a copy of it. See Packet A, number 59. Madame d'Épinay's departure is put off. Her son is ill, and she is obliged to wait until he is recovered. I will think over your letter. Stay quietly at your hermitage. I will let you know my opinion in time. As she will certainly not leave for some days, there is no hurry. Meanwhile, if you think fit, you can make your offers to her, although that appears to be a matter of indifference, for as I know your position as well as you know it yourself, I have no doubt that she will reply to them as she ought. It seems to me that the only thing to be gained by it is that you will be able to say to those who urge you that if you do not go, it will not be for want of having offered your services. Besides, I do not see why you think it absolutely necessary that the philosopher should be the speaking trumpet of all the world. And why do you imagine, because his advice is that you should go, that all your friends are of the same opinion? If you write to Madame d'Épinay, her answer may serve as a reply to all those friends, since you set such great store upon replying to them. Adieu. I salute Madame Levasseur and the criminal. Monsieur Levasseur was in the habit of calling his wife, who ruled him rather strictly, the criminal lieutenant. Grimm, in jest, gave the same name to the daughter, and for shortness afterwards omitted the second word. Greatly astonished by the perusal of this letter, I anxiously endeavoured to find out what it might mean, but in vain. What, instead of sending me a simple answer to my letter, he takes time to think over it? As if the time he had already taken had not been enough. He even informs me of the state of suspense in which he desires to keep me, as if it were a question of a difficult problem which had to be solved, or as if it was important to him to deprive me of every means of clearly understanding his feelings, until the moment when he should be pleased to declare them to me. What could be the meaning of all these precautions, this delay, this secrecy? Is this the way to respond to confidence? Does this look like honourable and upright behaviour? I sought in vain for some favourable interpretation of his conduct. I found none. Whatever his intention might be, his position made it easy for him to carry it out, if it was hostile to myself, while my own made it impossible for me to put any obstacle in his way. A favourite in the house of a great prince, with many acquaintances in the world, a man who gave the tone to the society in which we moved, whose oracle he was able, with the help of his usual cleverness, to arrange all his machinery as he pleased, whereas I, alone in my ermitage, far from all, without anyone to advise me, without communication with the outside world, could do nothing but wait and remain quiet. All I did was to write to Madame d'Épinay about her son's illness, as polite a letter as could possibly be, but in which I did not walk into the snare of offering to accompany her on her journey. After long waiting, in a state of cruel anxiety, into which this barbarous man had plunged me, I heard, 8 or 10 days later, that Madame d'Épinay had set out, and I received a second letter from him. It contained only 7 or 8 lines, which I did not read through. It proclaimed a rupture, but in terms such as only the most infernal hate can dictate, and which, from his eagerness to make them offensive, seemed almost silly. He forbade me to enter his presence, as he might have warned me off his estates. His letter, to make it appear ridiculous, only needed to be read with greater calmness. Without copying it, without even reading it to the end, I sent it back to him immediately with the following note. I refused to listen to my just suspicions. Too late I understand your character. This, then, is the letter which you wanted time to think over? I send it back to you. It is not for me. You can show mine to all the world, and hate me without concealment. That will be one falsehood less on your part. The permission which I gave him to show my preceding letter referred to a passage in his own, from which the reader will be enabled to judge of the profound adroitness with which he acted throughout the whole affair. I have said that, in the opinion of the uninitiated, my letter might have afforded many opportunities for attacking me. He was delighted to see it, but how was he to take advantage of it without compromising himself? If he showed the letter, he exposed himself to the reproach of abusing his friend's confidence. To relieve himself from this embarrassment, he determined to break off his relations with me in the most cutting manner possible, and to make me feel, in his letter, the favour which he did me by not showing mine. He felt quite certain that, in my indignant anger, I should reject his pretended discretion, and allow him to show my letter to everybody. This was exactly what he wanted, and everything turned out as he had planned. He sent my letter all round Paris, together with remarks of his own, which, however, did not prove so successful as he had expected. It was not considered that the permission to show my letter, which he had known how to extort from me, exempted him from reproach, for having so lightly taken me at my word in order to injure me. People kept asking what personal wrong I had done to him that could justify so violent a hatred. At last they came to the conclusion that, even if they had been of such a nature as to oblige him to break with me, friendship, even though extinguished, still had rights which he ought to have respected. But, unfortunately, Paris is frivolous. Impressions of the moment are soon forgotten. The unfortunate man who is absent is neglected. The prosperous man inspires respect by his presence. The game of intrigue and wickedness continues and is renewed, and its effects, unceasingly reviving, soon efface the past. This was the way in which this man, after having so long deceived me, at last threw off the mask, convinced that, in the state to which he had brought matters, he no longer needed it. Relieved from all apprehension of being unjust towards this wretch, I left him to his own reflections, and ceased to think of him. 8 days after the receipt of his letter, I received from Geneva an answer from Madame d'Épinay to my former letter, packet B, number 10. I saw from the tone which she assumed for the first time in her life that both, reckoning upon the success of their plans, were acting in concert, and that, looking upon me as a man lost beyond all hope of safety, they intended to devote themselves from that time forth, without any risk, to the pleasure of completely crushing me. In fact, my condition was most deplorable. I saw all my friends leaving me, without my knowing how or why. Diderot, who boasted of alone remaining faithful to me, and who had, for 3 months past, promised to pay me a visit, never came at all. The winter now began to make itself felt, and with it, attacks of my usual complaints. My constitution, although vigorous, had been unable to sustain the conflicts of so many contradictory passions. I was in a state of exhaustion, which left me neither strength nor courage to resist anything. Even if my promises, even if the continued remonstrances of Diderot and Madame Dudatot had allowed me to leave the Hermitage at this moment, I did not know either where to go or how to drag myself there. I remained stupid and motionless, without power to think or act. The mere idea of taking a step, of writing a letter, of saying a word, made me shudder. However, I could not leave Madame d'Épinay's letter unanswered, without confessing that I deserved the treatment with which she and her friend overwhelmed me. I decided to communicate my feelings and resolutions to her, not doubting for a moment that the feelings of humanity, generosity, propriety, and the good qualities which I believed I'd recognized in her, in spite of those that were bad, would make her hasten to agree with me. My letter was as follows. The Hermitage, November the 23rd, 1757. If one could die of grief, I should not be alive now. But at last I have made up my mind. All friendship between us is over, madam, but that which no longer exists still preserves its rights, which I know how to respect. I have by no means forgotten your kindness towards me, and you can reckon upon all the gratitude which a man can feel for one whom he can no longer love. All further explanation would be useless. I keep my own conscience and refer you to your own. I wanted to leave the Hermitage, and I ought to have done so, but it is declared that I must remain here until spring, and since my friends desire it, I will remain until then, if you consent to it. After this letter had been written and dispatched, my only thought was to remain quiet at the Hermitage, take care of my health, endeavour to recover my strength, and make arrangements to leave in the spring, without creating any disturbance or openly proclaiming the rupture. But this was not what Monsieur Grimm and Madame d'Épinay reckoned upon, as will be seen directly. A few days later, I at last had the pleasure of receiving from Diderot the visit which he had so often promised, and as often failed to keep his word. It could not have occurred at a more opportune moment. He was my oldest friend. He was almost the only friend I had left. Under these circumstances, my delight at seeing him may be imagined. My heart was full. I poured its contents into his. I enlightened him upon many facts which had been kept from him, or had been disguised or invented. I told him what I felt justified in telling him of all that had taken place. I made no pretense of concealing from him what he knew only too well, that a love, as unfortunate as it was foolish, had been the instrument of my destruction, but I never admitted that Madame Dudatot knew of it, or at least that I had declared it to her. I told him of Madame d'Épinay's unworthy artifices to intercept the very innocent letters written to me by her sister-in-law. I desired that he should learn these details from the lips of the persons whom she had attempted to seduce. Thérèse gave him an exact account of everything, but my feelings may be imagined when it came to the mother's turn, and I heard her declare and maintain that she knew nothing at all about it. This was her statement, in which she never wavered. Not 4 days since she had repeated all the details to me, and then, in my friend's presence, she flatly contradicted me. This attitude appeared to me decisive, and I then keenly felt my imprudence in having so long kept such a woman near me. I did not break out into invectives. I hardly condescended to say a few contemptuous words to her. I felt how much I owed to the daughter, whose unassailable uprightness contrasted strongly with her mother's contemptible cowardice. But from that moment my mind was made up in regard to the old woman, and I only waited for a suitable opportunity to carry out my determination. This opportunity came sooner than I had expected. On the 10th of December I received an answer from Madame d'Épinay. Its contents were as follows. Packet B, number 11. Geneva, December the 1st, 1757. After having given you for several years every possible proof of friendship and sympathy, I can now only pity you. You are very unhappy. I wish your conscience may be as clear as mine. That may be necessary for your future tranquillity. Since you wanted to leave the Hermitage and ought to have done so, I am astonished that your friends have prevented you. As for myself, I do not consult my friends as to my duties, and I have nothing more to say to you concerning yours. A dismissal so unexpected, but so clearly expressed, did not leave me a moment to hesitate. I was bound to leave the Hermitage at once, whatever the weather or the state of my health might be, even if I had to sleep in the woods or on the snow with which the ground was covered. And in spite of anything Madame Dudateau might say or do, for, although I was ready to humour her in everything, I was not prepared to disgrace myself. I found myself in the most terrible embarrassment of my life, but my mind was made up. I swore that, whatever might happen, I would not sleep in the Hermitage after a week. I set about removing my effects, having determined to leave them in the open field rather than keep the key longer than the week. For I was anxious, above all, that everything should be settled before anyone could write to Geneva and receive an answer. I was filled with a courage which I had never felt before. All my vigour had returned to me. Honour and indignation, upon which Madame d'Épinay had not reckoned, restored it to me. Fortune assisted my boldness. Monsieur Matard, procureur fiscal of Monsieur le Prince de Condé, heard of my difficulties. He offered me a little house which stood in his garden at Mont-Louis in Montmorency. I accepted his offer with eagerness and gratitude. The bargain was soon concluded. I hastily bought some furniture, in addition to what I had already, that Thérèse and myself might have a bed to sleep on. With great trouble and at great expense, I managed to get my goods removed in a cart. In spite of the ice and snow, my removal was effected in 2 days, and on the 15th of December I gave up the keys of the Hermitage, after having paid the gardener's wages, as I could not pay my rent. I told Madame Levasseur that we must separate. Her daughter tried to shake my resolution, but I was inflexible. I saw her off to Paris in the messenger's cart, with all the furniture and effects belonging to her and her daughter in common. I gave her some money, and undertook to pay for her lodgings with her children or elsewhere, to provide for her as long as it was in my power, and never to let her want for bread as long as I had any myself. Lastly, the day after my arrival at Mont-Louis, I wrote the following letter to Madame d'Épinay. Montmorency, December the 17th, 1757. Madam, nothing is so simple or so necessary as to leave your house, since you do not approve of my remaining there. As you refused to allow me to spend the rest of the winter at the Hermitage, I left it on the 15th of December. I was fated to enter and to leave it, in spite of myself. I thank you for the stay which you invited me to make there, and I would thank you still more if I had paid less dearly for it. You are right in thinking that I am unhappy. No one in the world knows better than yourself the extent of that unhappiness. If it is a misfortune to be deceived in the choice of one's friends, it is equally cruel to be disabused of so pleasant a mistake. Such is the true story of my stay at the Hermitage, and of the reasons which caused me to leave it. I have been unable to interrupt this narrative, and it was important to give the most exact details, since this period of my life has exercised an influence upon the future, the effects of which will last to my dying day. Book 10, 1758. The extraordinary energy with which a temporary irritation had enabled me to leave the Hermitage left me as soon as I was out of it. I was no sooner settled in my new abode than severe and frequent attacks of retention of urine were complicated by the fresh inconvenience of a rupture, which had for some time tortured me without my knowing that it was one. I soon became subject to the most painful attacks. My old friend Thierry came to see me and enlightened me as to my condition. Probes, bogies, bandages, and all the preparations for the infirmities of age, which were collected around me, made me feel rudely that one can no longer have a young heart without suffering for it, when the body has ceased to be young. The fine weather did not restore my strength, and I passed the whole of 1758 in a state of weakness, which made me believe that I was near the end of my career. I saw it approaching almost with eagerness, cured of idle dreams of friendship, separated from everything which had made me fond of life. I no longer saw anything in it which could make it agreeable. I saw nothing but misery and suffering, which prevented me from all self-enjoyment. I yearned for the moment when I should be free and beyond the reach of my enemies. But let us take up the thread of events again. It appears that my retirement to Montmorency disconcerted Madame d'Épinay. Probably she had not expected it. My melancholy condition, the severity of the weather, and my general loneliness made her and Grimm believe that, by driving me to the last extremity, they would compel me to cry for mercy, and to degrade myself to the depths of meanness, in order to be left in the refuge which honour ordered me to leave. I changed my quarters so abruptly that they had not time to anticipate the step. No alternative was left to them except to go double or quits and ruin me completely, or to endeavour to get me back. Grimm was in favour of the former, but I believe that Madame d'Épinay would have preferred the latter. I am inclined to believe this from her answer to my last letter, in which she adopted a much milder tone and seemed to open the door to reconciliation. This time she made me wait for an answer. A whole month is a sufficient indication of the difficulty which she found in giving it a suitable turn, and of the anxious thought which she devoted to it. She could not go further without committing herself, but, after her previous letters and my abrupt departure from her house, one cannot but be struck by the pains she has taken in this letter not to allow a single uncivil word to creep in. In order that the reader may judge for himself, I will give it in full. Packet B, number 23. Geneva, January the 17th, 1758. Sir, I did not receive your letter of the 17th of December until yesterday. It was sent to me in a box filled with different things, which has been all this time on its way. I will only answer the postscript. As for the letter itself, I do not clearly understand it, and if it were possible for us to come to an explanation, I would gladly set down all that has passed to a misunderstanding. To return to the postscript, you may remember that we agreed that the gardener's wages should be paid through you, to make him feel that he was dependent upon you, and to spare you the laughable and unseemly scenes which his predecessor had caused. A proof of this is that his first quarter's wages was handed to you, and a few days before I left I arranged with you to repay what you advanced. I know that at first you made a difficulty about it, but I had asked you to make these advances. I had merely to discharge my obligations, and this we agreed upon. Cahouet has told me that you refused to accept this money. There must be some mistake about the matter. I have ordered it to be offered to you again. I do not see why you should want to pay my gardener, in spite of our agreement, even beyond the time of your stay at the Hermitage. Therefore, sir, I feel sure that, remembering all that I have the honour to tell you, you will not refuse to take back the money which you have been kind enough to advance. After all that passed, being no longer able to trust Madame d'Épinay, I did not desire to renew my connection with her. I did not answer the letter at all, and our correspondence ended with it. Seeing that I had made up my mind, she did the same, and entering into all the plans of Grimm and the Olbachian clique, she united her efforts with theirs in order to ruin me. While they were working at Paris, She was working at Geneva. Grimm, who afterwards went to join her, finished what she had begun. Tronchin, whom they easily gained over, vigorously assisted them, and became my most violent persecutor, without having the least cause of complaint against me, any more than Grimm. All three, acting together, secretly sowed in Geneva the seed which, 4 years later, was seen to spring up. They found more difficulty in Paris, where I was better known, and where people's hearts, less disposed to hatred, did not receive its impressions so easily. In order to deal their blows more adroitly, they began by spreading the report that it was I who had left them. See Delaire's letter, packet B, number 30. Starting with that, and pretending to be still my friends, they cleverly sowed the seeds of their malicious accusations in the form of complaints against the injustice of their friend. The result of this was that their hearers, thrown off their guard, were more inclined to listen to them and to blame me. The secret accusations of treachery and ingratitude were spread with greater precaution, and for that very reason with greater effect. I knew that they accused me of the most heinous crimes, without ever being able to learn in what, according to them, they consisted. All that I could infer from public report was that they were reduced to these four capital offences,